genes, B, to change our lifestyle, and C, eventually to replace diseased and aging organs as they wear out. So don't think this is going to happen anytime soon. However, there's nothing in the laws of biology to prevent us from extending the lifespan. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. So join us every week when we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. This is Dr. Michio Kaku. And once again, our special guests have been Dr. William Calvin, speaking about A Brief History of the Mind, and Dr. Jay Olshansky, author of the book The Quest for Immortality. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. And be sure to dial into my website. It's www.mkaku.org, mkaku.org. Good day.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio wouldn't be here without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our spring membership drive, taking place now through May 25th. Your contribution goes towards postmodern, avant-garde, alternative radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kboo.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kboo.fm.
Follow KBOO on Instagram at KBOO Radio. Ear to the Streets.
Hey, Michael here. I'm with the Tin Can Phone Podcast, a radio show where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the source. We tell you the story from the inside out, so make sure to check us out on KBOO Community Radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
You just tuned into the Global Sale with TK Tabarura. And what can I say? This is one of the brand new public affairs shows here at KBOO. And well, TK is going to introduce you to amazing things tonight. Go for it.
Oh, thank you, Andrew. Tonight, we take you to Northeast Africa, also known as the Horn of Africa. We're referring to Somalia, one of the nations in the region. As most of us know, immigrants and refugees are from any part of the world. And today, our Global Sale Show is going to take us to that Somali. Immigration remains a hot topic, and it touches millions of people, their friends, neighbors, and anybody who is concerned on any given day. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce you to our special guest, Mahad Hassan from Somalia. He's based here in Portland, Oregon. I'll give him space to introduce himself. Mahad, please welcome to the Global Sale Show. Will you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Thank you, TK. Thank you for having me. My name is Mahad Hassan, and I am from Somalia. I've been in the United States since 2001, almost 23 years. Happy to be here with you all and get you a chance to know my country and my culture.
Oh, thank you, Mahad. For those just joining us this evening, we want to tour Somalia tonight. I'm going to take you on this global sale show. So we want to understand the situation and the culture in Somalia. Our guest, Mahad, will shed some light on what he knows and understands about Somalia based on his lived experience. So for warm-up, I will start with a popular song from Somalia. This song, Mahad, may you introduce the song for us, please, to the audience?
Yeah, this is a very popular song by Fadumo Kassam. She is a well-known Somali artist. It is very lyrical. Somali music has both traditional vibe to it as well as a modern vibe to it. So I'll give you a chance all for you all to enjoy this song.
Thank you, Mahad.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was a very popular song from Somalia. And
yeah, that was a song by Fadumo Qasim, really popular musician in the 1980s. As you can tell, she has a very sweet lyrical sound. And on top of that, you can hear the guitar player playing over there. And that's a form of Somali music that I enjoy, and that I think a lot of people in my community would be familiar with.
Oh, thank you, Mahad. That was beautiful. I really enjoyed this piece so much. And thank you for introducing it. So for those just joining us, I'm speaking to our special guest on the Global Sale Show, Mahad Hassan. We want to talk more about Somalia communities and want to feel the experience and learn a little bit more about what makes Somalia unique or special. So let's get into this, Mahad. Can you please briefly tell me the situation in Somalia today? What's going on in Somalia?
Yeah, the situation in Somalia is complex, to say the least. It's going to probably take us hours to be able to explore it. Uh-huh. But the things that Somalia oftentimes is dealing with is political conflict, to say the least. Mm-hmm. There is also a kind of a conflict regarding how do you best go about establishing a kind of a governmental institutions. But on top of that, the larger issues are humanitarian issues. You have people who don't have access to basic services. You mm-hmm. also have a security situation that is pretty tense. Uh-huh. But also you have an innovative private sector, yes. as well as an innovative voluntary sector that has stepped in over the last 20 to 25 years since the collapse of the Somali state. Mm-hmm. All too often we hear that Somalia is a failed country, but it's a failed governmental structure, mm-hmm. but it's not a failed society. Right. The society is still vibrant. People are able to function in spite of the lack of strong governmental structures.
So you raise very interesting points here. You speak about a collapsed system. First of all, I wanted to know, like, for how long has this been going on and what caused it?
Yeah, the collapse of the Somali state was really a byproduct of, I think in so many ways, colonialism. Mm-hmm. The Somali state was constituted with the reuniting of Somali British land, British Somaliland, mm-hmm. as well as Italian Somaliland. And so that goes to show you had two colonial masters and two different systems, and you had to come together. And mm-hmm. so they were able to come together in the 1960s, and Somalia became an independent nation state. But then following that, we also had in the background the Cold War, and Somalia was located in a very strategic position, and it is still located in a very strategic position. Uh-huh. And so the Soviets, along with the Americans, were competing for Somali interests. And one of the things that they help sort of perpetuate is the rise of a strong military mm-hmm. in so many different ways. And you had the overthrow of a democratically elected president, and then you had the emergence of an individual known as Said Barre, who would go on to rule the country for over 20 odd years. And then after, you know, the way dictators all too often work is they pit people against each other. They first come there as saviors, and I think a lot of people in Somalia were like, oh, okay, you're Said Barre, a military person. He can put structures together and get rid of this problematic parliamentary system that we had. But he was also really good at, you know, clan-based politics. And that's mm-hmm. one of the reasons that the Somali state in so many different ways failed is the adverse use of clan-based politics, whereby I'm a member of this clan, therefore mm-hmm. I get privileges and rights, as mm-hmm. opposed to if you're a member of that clan and this clan. And also, the Civil War was also a result of the fact that, you know, no longer were the Soviets interested in Somalia, no longer were the Americans interested in Somalia, because the Soviet Union had ended. And so the U.S. was on a march toward a kind of a, like, oh, Africa, we must democratize because now it serves our interest.
Right.
And so they, you know, they stopped supporting him, and people, after years of authoritarian governance and throwing people in jail, people got fed up. People in the North in particular got fed up, and they were able to, you know, there was an overthrow of him, but there was never a way of getting the state back together. There was no agreement of, like, how do we move on beyond Saeed Barre?
Right.
And that's a byproduct of the current situation. It's like there is a kind of a focus on, like, a strong man in so many different ways who can supposedly hold the country together. But I'll leave it at that right now.
Okay. So just taking you back, we'll step back a little bit. So before Siad Barre took over power, who was the first democratically elected president of Somalia?
Adam Yusuf. I'm thinking I could be butchering his name. Adam Yusuf was the first democratically elected president of Somalia. I could be wrong, but I'm thinking somebody named Adam. And he was, you know, he was president for 4 or 5 years. And then the approach to governance at that time was really around nationalism. Like, the people were really eager to get the nation reconstructed. They were eager to throw off the yoke of colonialism and see what the Somali people as a collective can do. But there was, in the background, you always had the kind of tension between the northern Somalia, which was ruled by the British, as well as southern Somalia, which was ruled by the Italians. And the first president came from southern Somalia. But I think there was a tacit agreement between the leaders in the north and the south around, like, okay, this is the way we should share power.
Right.
It was much more of a consultative approach. But I think one of the things that all too often happens is, like, people get away from that. They get away from that kind of a, like, okay, let's unite at first, but then somebody wants to gain the advantage. And then, you know, there was not a focus on creating institutions. There was a focus on, like, the dominance of one party, which was the Somali Youth League, which both the North and the South agreed on. And when you have one, this kind of a one-party approach, all too often you have negative recompunctions of it. So that's one of the reasons the first president kind of fell away. And then you had a president named Shamarke who came along. He was a prime minister and then became a president as well. And he was influential, but you still had the kind of vote-getting, kind of clan-based politics. And people were tired of it because roads were not being built. Things were not functioning the way they were supposed to be. Things were not moving at the rate that they were moving. People were getting patronage based on their clan associations, and people were tired of that. And so they gravitated toward this military leader, Saeed Barre, who was like, I'm all about Somali nationalism.
Right.
Let's all of us get together. And for a couple of years, he got the country moving in so many different ways. You had a higher literacy rate. Health care was provided to people. And all this was under the banner of socialism. At first, he was in bed with the Soviets and the socialists, and then when the Soviets and the socialists started supporting Ethiopia, which led to the Somali conflict with Ethiopia, where he sent forces into Ethiopia, and the Ethiopians were being backed by Cubans who were in bed with the Soviets. He was like, okay, I need to switch, and literally he switched to the Americans. And so with Somalia, all too often, I think there are internal dynamics, but all too often you have external actors that play a significant role, and you have that throughout Africa, but a lot more pronounced in Somalia in particular.
Oh, great. Right. So for those just joining us, we have Mahad Hassan from Somalia. We're talking about Somalia here. I'm going to just let you, Mahad, explain to our audience what are the bordering nations around Somalia?
Yeah, Somalia is bordered it's bordered by Ethiopia. It's bordered by Kenya. It's also bordered by Djibouti. And it has a long coastline. I say Djibouti in particular. Djibouti used to be called French Somaliland, mm-hmm. but the name was changed. The people who live there are mm-hmm. ethnically Somalis. And then Ethiopia as well, you have a large ethnic Somali population in Kenya as well. Mm-hmm. So the three main countries are Ethiopia, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Djibouti
okay.
that border Somalia.
So why is it a hotspot? Why is it, what's so special about Somalia? Because I see the Soviet is interested in Somalia mm-hmm. back in the day. Mm-hmm. I see the Americans are interested in yeah. Somalia. Mm-hmm. I see the Cubans, yeah. you explained, they are interested. The British are also interested.
Yeah.
What was that magnet that was causing all these
yeah.
superpowers to be interested?
It's because of the strategic location of Somalia and the fact that Somalia has a large coastline, one of the largest in Africa, about 5,000 kilometers or long.
Wow.
And it's close to the Red Sea, close to the Suez Canal,
mm-hmm.
Where a lot of oil goes through. So it's a strategic location, and the Soviets wanted to be able to build kind of naval installations there. And for years, they had naval installations. The Americans also wanted access to the Red Sea so they could deal with hotspots, supposedly, in the Middle East, where they had a lot more vested interest, especially in the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wanted to keep the Soviets out, and right. so that's why they got interested. They were like, okay, if the Soviets have a foothold on Somalia,
yeah.
it'll be easier for them to get into the Gulf countries and create some conflict for us or slow down the flow of oil. So it's a strategic location of mm-hmm. Somalia in particular, more than anything else, that external actors, especially in the West, and you know, in the multipolar kind of a world of the Soviet days,
mm-hmm.
Were interested in.
So what caused these nations to elbow each other out, like to leave the Somali people alone?
Yeah, I mean, it's all too often, I think, the Somali people were, you know, trying to play one over the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was a movement throughout the world, the non-alignment movement, and
yeah.
Somalis were along with those lines, were like, okay, if you're going to help us
yes.
with this particular thing, we're going to be on your side. If you're going to help us with this particular thing, we're going to be on the Soviet side
right.
due to the Americans. And so, but as the Cold War became a lot more hot, mm-hmm. in the sense of like you had to pick sides,
yes.
that became not an option. And that was always facilitated by the interest of the guy who was in power, who wanted to keep power. Like, are the Soviets gonna, you know, make sure that I am less accountable to my people? I'm gonna
mm-hmm.
go with the Americans, the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So these external forces are always at play that undermine the ability of the Somali people to kind of chart their own course.
Wow, that's very interesting. So in this situation right now,
mm-hmm.
what's the current issue that's causing a lot of immigration to happen? Why do we have
mm-hmm.
a number of Somalis leaving Somaliland right now? What's causing that? And do you see any change coming along the way?
Yeah, one of the most particular and salient things that currently that's causing Somalis to migrate, it's for years Somalis were migrating because of the civil war, where you had the collapse of the state,
mm-hmm.
Where you had active conflict, where you have warring people. Somalis had warlords for years,
mm-hmm.
Fighting each other out for control over cities and stuff. Safety, and now a lot more climate. The climate crisis is hitting Somalia in dramatic ways. Somalis are a kind of agricultural as well as a kind of a husband. They can depend a lot on the nomadic life and husbandry, goat, sheep,
mm-hmm.
Camels.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they're getting killed, and so you're seeing droughts to an extent that has been a lot more accentuated, a lot more profound than ever before. Somalis have always dealt with drought,
mm-hmm.
but the intensity in which the drought is happening, in which people are losing livestock, and that's the wealth of Somali people all too
mm-hmm.
often. There are some agricultural communities, but all too often, I would say 75 to 80% of Somalis are nomadic. And when you don't have,
mm-hmm.
you know, rainfall,
mm-hmm.
and pasture lands that are, you know, not possible any longer. There were few to begin with,
yeah.
But now the climate crisis has accentuated that in more ways than anything else. The climate crisis, along with the civil war,
mm-hmm.
and people seeking better opportunities,
mm-hmm.
And the fact that there is a political conflict that is raging there, and certain populations are a lot more vulnerable. In particular, you know, people who are young young kids are a lot more vulnerable, older people are a lot more vulnerable, mm-hmm. and in particular, if you do not have somebody sending you remittances. And that's the interesting thing about the Somali migration experience, where you have people go all over the world, but always yeah. sending money back.
Yes.
That is not accessible to a large majority of the populations. It's small, like 20 to 25% of the people in Somalia do get that, yes. but a vast majority of the people have to earn living somehow,
yes.
and that's not possible anymore. Mm-hmm. There are some innovative ways the Somali economy is moving along, but it's also leaving a lot of people behind who don't have access to those opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have the state there facilitating those opportunities. You don't have functioning systems happening. But over the last 10 to 15 years, there has been an initiative on the part of the international community, mm-hmm. NGOs in particular, to get the state functioning.
Yes.
But it is nowhere near anything that it was previously prior to the 1991 civil war.
Mm-hmm.
And you have rampant corruption as well. So that's an ongoing problem. And I think ultimately Somalis will have to do some soul searching themselves, be mm-hmm. able to figure out, like, how do we move forward? How do we recreate our bonds of brotherhood and begin to reconstitute the nation? Mm-hmm. But ultimately, one of the things that I see with the Somali people is a strong nationalist drive,
right?
But also a kind of a clannish focus that somehow subtracts from that nationalist drive, where you're interested in your clan,
yes.
more than all too often the nation. but you love the nation also, right. which is conflicting, to say
my
the least.
My tribe first.
Yeah, yep.
So talking about the geographical situation in Somalia, what fraction do we have for the desert?
Yeah, I mean, a large fraction of Somalia is arid desert, and that's one of the reasons why you have a lot of clan conflicts, because clans are competing for, in particular, grazing land, uh-huh. because they're nomadic people in Somalia, a lot majority of them. And so, a large swath of Somalia is pretty arid. Uh-huh. There's the Shebeli, which is a major river in Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of vegetation and all that, there are certain regions of Somalia where you have that, but a large majority of Somalia is arid, where you just have a lot of sand, desert. But people still cultivate life out of there, and the Somali right. character is formed from that kind of a harsh environment, and Somali traditions yeah. are formed from that kind of a harsh environment. You would see within those arid regions, trees were still able to grow, but over uh-huh. the years, there has been a cutting of trees, deforestation.
Oh, really?
Somalia didn't have a large forest to begin with,
mm-hmm.
but you're seeing over the last, since the Civil War started, where you don't have the state protecting the environment, people just cutting down trees, and that's mm-hmm. Leading to a lot more environmental degradation.
Oh, that's unfortunate to hear. I'm curious about the camels.
Mm-hmm.
Can you please educate me regarding camels? I've always been curious. Mm-hmm. Are they wild? Mm-hmm. Are they tamed? What's the situation with camels? They fascinate me.
Yeah, they're both wild and they're also tamed.
Mm-hmm.
I am not an expert on it. And it's funny, I'm a Somali. I do have a nomadic background, but they are very much revered animals. You can see with a lot of Somali symbols, the camel.
Yeah.
Most of them are tamed. Most of them belong to people.
Right.
There might be some wild ones, but a lot of them belong to people who use them for milk, who use them for trade, who use the food of the camel. It's an asset more than anything else.
Okay.
And there are so many different songs about it. There's so many different sayings about the camel mm-hmm. in Somali traditions in so many different ways. So the camel is really essential to Somalia. But as I spoke earlier, because of the rise in the climate situation and mm-hmm. the perpetuation of the climate getting a lot more problematic, especially in Somalia, with the rise of more frequent droughts.
Uh-huh.
Like I said earlier, Somalis have been used to droughts, but not the frequency we have seen. You're seeing a lot of camels dying and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, is their meat edible? is the meat, the camel meat, edible?
Of course, the camel meat is edible. I have tasted once or twice. It's not my favorite thing. I am more of a goat meat kind of a person.
All right, good to know. So we're going to move on to the next song from Somalia. Mahad, will you please introduce this song for us to our audience?
Yeah, this is a very popular Somali song. It's known for its upbeat and lively melody. The title roughly translates the sea waves of the coast in English. The song celebrates the natural beauty of Somalia's coastal regions and invokes a sense of nostalgia and longing for Somalia's maritime heritage. Somalis have a huge maritime heritage because of the large sea coastline that we have. So,
wow. So this was the song from Somalia. It's called, let me pull up the name right here.
Dahab Barahmata.
And can you, Mahad, briefly describe to our audience what this song was about?
Yeah, it was about the sea waves. It was about maritime Somalia. It was about the coast regions of Somalia and kind of a pride in our in that kind of a heritage the Somalis have. Somalis have a rich maritime heritage, not only reflected on the fact that we live along the huge coastline, but also we travel throughout the world, and you see Somalis all over the world. And even, you know, one of the heritages in terms of maritime is like Somalis being on British scooters, traveling all the way to England and back, and then even pre that, going to Turkey. So there is a rich tradition of Somalia and the sea in particular.
Oh, that's very interesting. Thank you for sharing that. I'm going to now divert from the political situation we're covering a little while ago. For those just joining us, welcome to the Global Sail Show. This is TK Kapara. My host this evening is Mahad Hassan from Somalia. We're discussing more lifestyles in of Somalia, the culture and everything. We just covered the political space. Now we're turning to the social life in Somalia. So Mahad, back to social life. What's life like on a random day in Somalia? What's the capital city of Somalia?
Yeah, the capital city is Mogadishu.
Right.
And a day would be, you know, Somalis are pretty family-oriented people. And I go back to this idea of you know, not a lot of people are going to have formal jobs. Some people might work informally. And so your day would probably begin with your family, even, you know, having kind of a prayer with the family, going to the mosque and then heading off to work. And then in the mid afternoon and having breakfast. Breakfast is a particularly important meal in Somali culture, where people have what is known as injera. And sometimes the injera is had with suqar or some other kind of a meat.
What's the injera made of?
The injera is made out of wheat, but I also understand that the injera that Americans are quite used to and have seen is more of Ethiopian injera, which is made out of teff. But the Somali injera is made out of wheat in particular. And so it's like a smaller version of Ethiopian injera and a lot more digestible in that sense, at least in my eyes. So they would you would have breakfast. Then if you have a job, you would head out to the job. And then in around 2 to 3, people would have lunch. And lunch is pretty popular as well, where people are able to take time and just have a meal and enjoy themselves and be in the company of others. And in the mid-afternoon, you would have tea, and then you would come back from work and then be with your family. And if you have friends, go visit them. Somalis are pretty social people in particular. They like visiting each other in particular. And and if there's a game on, Somalis are soccer fanatics. They would watch soccer from all over the world. Or, you know, just go to the market, go to the cinema in particular. And there are variations depending on what age a person is. I think the elders in particular are a lot more oriented toward, you know, the richer traditions of Somalia, which is a lot more focused on poetry in particular and a lot more of like being able to talk about global events, like and Somalis are interested in the globe as well, talking about the news in particular, but a lot more older people are seem to be that and be able to tell stories more than anything else. You have that community members who are repositories of different experiences from years upon years ago, and being able to pass along stories to family members, to members of the extended family. So I think the other thing that I want to mention is like there's a lot of modernity in Somalia. So people will probably be using their cell phones. Mm-hmm. You have an innovative telecommunications structure and private sector in Somalia where people are able to pay things through their cell phones, like wow. pay for gasoline, pay for food. Mm-hmm. And that's really also East Africa where you have like mobile payment systems that are local that are able to do that. And then I think the other thing that I want to mention is that a lot of Somalis are part of the informal sector, mm-hmm. Where they're selling things on the street. They're right. trying to find a means to an end. And you see that in the streets where you have a lively kind of a market. Sometimes mm-hmm. you have the markets at night where people just go out there, be at the night, even at the as opposed to the day. A day is different. But if you're a young person, your day would probably be, you know, with school, mm-hmm. And then coming home and doing your homework and then playing soccer out in the street and being with your friends. Somalis in Somalia come from different socioeconomic backgrounds. So if you have access to a cell phone or something else, you would probably be on the cell phone. If you have a video game, you'd be on a video game. Right. And so like you'd be playing Fortnite and stuff. So I bet there are a bunch of kids in Somalia playing a lot of Fortnite, which is not to the delight of their parents.
Great. So do they have a lot of breweries in Somalia? Breweries that brew beer?
No. Somalis are Muslim people.
Yeah.
They're not consumers of alcohol, but I have to say, since I work in the community behavioral health field and I deal with clients who have mm-hmm. addiction issues from the Somali community, there are people in our community in Somalia as well yeah. as in the United States who do drink, uh-huh. But I don't think we have any kind of inebriating beverage in our culture.
Really?
One of the things the Somalis are really well known for is chewing a leaf called khat, which is quite common in Northeast Africa and uh-huh. Yemen as well,
yeah.
Which is a stimulant, and it can have negative effects on the person in terms of their appearance and in particular their dental health,
yeah.
as well as their mental abilities. But if you use traditionally, the way Somalis used it was in celebrations mm-hmm. and after having completed a long sort of a pasturing season,
right.
Coming together, telling stories.
Uh-huh.
But now I think in modern times, a lot of people turn to it as a way of alleviating, you know, a lot of stress.
Uh-huh.
And it's problematic to say the least, but it's a very common the drug of choice in Somalia is khat. The drug of choice is not alcohol.
And it's not illegal.
It's not illegal in a sense, but I think the Somali people in particular, as well as the fledgling government, is beginning to recognize they need to regulate it.
Yeah.
And they need to be mindful of like warning people about the negative consequences of it. It's not a innocuous kind of a drug. It can have a devastating personal uh-huh. and social familial mm-hmm. impact.
Great. So I want to just do some quick questions here. Do you guys have nightclubs in that regard? Since they don't drink, I was curious, like, are there any nightclubs in Somalia and Mogadishu?
Of course there are nightclubs. and of course there's drinking going on.
Yeah.
But it's not culturally acceptable.
Okay.
So if people are doing it, they're doing it in secret or in kind of like... And the other thing that I want least listeners to be mindful of, like, I left Somalia when I was about 4 or 5 years old,
uh-huh.
And I lived the rest of my years before we got to the U.S. in Kenya,
yeah.
And so I do have relatives over there, but I do not have any concrete information about right. the happenings on a daily basis. But
okay.
I think from what I've seen from YouTube, from what I've heard, you know, in terms of other sources, yeah, there are nightclubs, there are people mm-hmm. who are drinking. And you have a rising middle class as well, and so they might gravitate toward that. But religiously and traditionally, the culture scoffs at those kinds of things. But I think even in the 80s and the 70s, you always had nightclubs that if you wanted to, you have a good time. And I think Somalis like to dance in particular.
Yeah.
You can dance, but I don't think they would be openly serving alcohol. It would probably be under the counter.
Okay. So drinking would be publicly condemned,
yep.
It would say.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So back to the regular life again in Somalia. What are the sports, most popular sports, sporting activities from Somalia? And do you have any stars that have been like global icons on the sports platform?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about East Africa is that we're known for running.
Yeah.
So there is a Somali person in Mohamed Farah, or I'm butchering his name, but he won the gold medal in long distance running for not Somalia, but for Britain, because they gave him asylum. Right. So he was running under their flag.
Uh-huh.
Running is something the Somalis, to an extent, long distance running Somalis excel at, similar to Kenyans, similar to Ethiopians and Djiboutis probably. But the other sports the Somalis really are passionate about is soccer.
Okay.
In particular, like there is a love of soccer, like every man in particular, young boy is like fascinated with soccer, and you play the game of soccer. Nice. By any means necessary. Like you play it with garbage bags pulled together.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
If you don't have a soccer ball, you play it in the streets.
Uh-huh.
And some people, like some young people, are like, I'm going to be the next Ronaldo or Pele.
Right.
And so there's that kind of a push. And basketball has become a lot more popular. And I think it comes from watching NBA players in particular.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And being able to emulate them and say like, oh, I can be the next, you know, Michael Jordan or the next, you know, LeBron.
Yes.
But soccer is the main sport the Somalis are just diehard about. And running is something that I think Olympically and on the world stage, the Somalis find pride in when one of them wins some kind of a world championship.
I want to ask you a childish question about Somalis and long distance running.
Yeah,
is there a secret to why East Africans are so talented? Do they train a lot, or is inbred in them, or what's the secret? Why are they interested in running, and why do they make it so well and so successful in this field?
Yeah, I mean that is a question that is like a $1 million question, but also people have written books about it. And it has to do with, to some extent, the genetic makeup, to an extent, having smaller muscles that are not too lengthy, and then the ability to be endurance, going without water for a long period of time, in particular. But I think it's the environment in which people are always using their bodies, and they're using their bodies efficiently. And that is inherited from generation to generation. That is my speculation. There is no scientific grounding in that. I think that's one of the reasons. And you can see the Kenyans are pretty long-distance runners. The Ethiopians are pretty good long-distance runners. The Djiboutis are. Somalis are also. But the Kenyans take the mark in particular. There are certain regions in Kenya in particular where people are just fantastic runners. If they train, they're able to get to a world championship level. I think the Somalis are probably third or fourth in that sense. I would probably give it the Kenyans and then the Ethiopians and then perhaps the Somalis and Djiboutis.
So is there like a community project where the community members come together like, okay, let's practice running, or it just happens naturally, then people discover themselves?
Yeah, it's not something that is natural. I think all too often the Somali experience has been like conserving food in particular and not over exhausting yourself. And there is a value in being big in Somali culture, like they want people to be. And so exercising in itself is an anathema to the Somali people. But I think as over the years, as you know, the world has become more global and there's a focus on sports, the Somalis caught on to that bandwagon. But I don't think it's inherently part of Somali culture to like, to be long distance runners. I think communities do come around people who are good at that kind of sports and highlight them and support them.
Right, perfect. We're going to now take another 90 degrees to a different topic. We're going to talk about what offends the people of Somalia. Every culture has something that's offending, right?
Yeah.
So if I were to be in Somalia, what should I not do or what should I not say so that I end up in trouble?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most basic things is not, you know, kind of disrespecting the Islamic religion. Mm-hmm. And I want to be cautious about that. Like, you know, in the West, we have freedom of speech. And that is, and in itself can be very tricky to talk about. But like just basically respecting a person's religion, in particular Islamic religion, if you're in Somalia, I would probably be cautious around displaying crosses. It's seen as insensitive. Basically, disrespecting another human being in particular, disrespecting the, you know, a person's family, a person's clan in particular, you know, sort of like, you know, things that are important to the culture and you're kind of showing insensitivity to it, that's just not going to look good. Kind of like being too confrontational in public and being too argumentative. I have to also say, like, Somalis are argumentative people, but to be openly argumentative in public is seen as a show of disrespect. But overall, I think the Somali people are complex people, and I don't think, other than egregious insult to one's culture, one's way of life, they're willing to respect other people as well and not take serious offense.
Can you share more about women's rights in Somalia?
Yeah, I mean, women's rights in Somalia are good. I think the best person you would ask that is a woman in Somalia. But let me try to give you an understanding. I think all too often we paint Africans, Islamic people, as having kind of a backward view of women. And that's a dilemma that we have to be able to sit with and be able to counter that kind of a narrative. I think women have a special place, have always had a unique place in Somali society, within Somali families, within our culture. And so I wouldn't say their experiences are similar to Western women. They're different. They're different expectations. They're kind of a traditionalist culture in which everybody has a kind of a role to play. And behavior of, like, women in particular is kind of, you know, there is certain expectations that is not, like, placed upon men. And so there is a large degree of sexism and misogyny, I have to say that. But I want to be really cautious in this idea of, like, okay, Somalis, Africans, Muslim people have a kind of a backward view of women in particular. It's just a different way of life and a different view of human relationships and and stuff. But I think there has been a movement over the last couple of years in which women are playing a much more significant role. You have women who have, I think since the Civil War, they held families together. It was the women all too often who held families together. And I think I'm playing along the lines of, like, okay, women are nurturing people.
Right.
But on top of that, the Somali women in particular now are in parliament, they're in business, they're in education.
Right.
They're far outpacing the men in so many different ways. And also look at Somali women in the diaspora.
Yes.
Somali women are more likely to be more educated than Somali men, especially in the United States.
Really?
They're able to hold down careers. They're, you know, I would say it's switched. And also in modern day Somalia, you're seeing a lot more stories of independent, conscientious women being presented because of the internet.
Right.
People being able to talk about their experiences with misogyny in their family, within our culture. And so you're having young women and young girls in particular, and women in particular, kind of questioning the way the Somali culture treats women, and they're moving the conversation along, and I don't think they're following a kind of a Western feminist approach. They're more in line with the critical Black feminist approach to things, where you know your community and you're not trying to demonize your community.
Right.
You're seeing the complexity of it, but you're also demanding certain rights, certain considerations that you as a human being deserve. So,
great.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So I'm just going to ask you a generic question. For those just joining us, we have Mahad Hassan from Somalia. Northeast Africa. We're talking here on the Global Sale Show. I'm your host, TK Kapura. Mahad, one other question I would ask you would be, I understand a lot of our immigrant populations bring something to the USA. There are countries that bring a certain special food, some bring a special kind of dress code. What would Somalis be known for as what they bring to the U.S. platform?
I think ultimately, I think Somalis bring their entrepreneurial spirit. They're remarkably entrepreneurial people,
right,
able to open up businesses, halal shops, you know, remittances,
right,
trucking companies, and all that. And I think that's what they bring. And I think a lot of immigrants bring that entrepreneurship experience where all too often you're shut out of the professional sector because you don't have credentials that are matching with the system that you're immigrating into. Mm-hmm. And so you do your own Uber, you try to find another way to do a particular job. And so innovation in the sense of the working and that entrepreneurial spirit in particular, I think that's what they bring.
Oh, great. So before we wind up, I want to ask you one last question. What's your message? What's your special message to the people of America, one side, and to the Somalis at large, one side? So two questions.
Yeah. I would say to the people of America that Somalia is much more interesting, it's much more problematic, it's much more complex,
mm-hmm.
it's much more beguiling than we have been shown,
mm-hmm.
And that I would just, you know, I would get rid of the your preconceived notions of like people who are starving, the notion of failed state. It's a complex country. We are complex people in particular.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of resiliency, a lot of faults as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think just kind of like having an open-mindedness and being able to say like, hey, what I've been told about this part of the world is probably not all that accurate, the media in particular, because they like to sensationalize things. And the people of Somalia, I would say, like, to Somali people, I think one of the things that we're able to show through our experience is that, you know, there is hope, and that people are able to start over again, and that we're able to start lives in the U.S., and we're able to start lives in Asia, in Africa, build businesses, gain careers. We should be able to do that back home as well. And so ultimately, I think we have to engage in that deeper work as a people and as a society to figure out what is it that is keeping us from, you know, flourishing in our own home country.
Oh, thank you so much, Mahad. We're coming to the end of the show. I'm so thankful to you, our listeners, for listening to us as we took you on a Global Sale Show with Mahad Hassan from Somalia. And we're going to leave you with a song named I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free by Nina Simone. Thank you so much for listening. Until we meet again on the first Wednesday of every month at 7 p.m. on KBOO 92.7 FM. Have a great day. In Somalia, our goodbye would be said by Mahad.
Salam. Salam, 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 salam.
Thank you for listening in. You have a great evening.
Yeah.
have some gravy in your ear. This is Wavy Gravy, Temple of Accumulated Error and Voice of Woodstock, telling you you are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM. The 90s are the 60s, standing on your head.